Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. We got a great podcast for you today. My guests are artist for Smugby Games and Game Wisdom site designer, Kenneth Olm.
You there?
And our special guest this week, he is the founder of the International Game Developers Association, otherwise known as the IGDA. He has been a member of the game industry now for over 20 years. He has written several books and major blogs on game design in the industry. And he's currently a consultant for Adams Consulting Services in the UK. Please welcome Ernest Adams.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here and have the opportunity to talk to all you people.
Yep, it is definitely a pleasure, Ernest, especially considering just how much of an impact you've had on the industry over these last 20 years.
Well, I've written some things. I've talked to some people. Yeah, I'm not a big name like, you know, Peter Molyneux or Cliff Bleszinski, but I've worked, you know, more among developers themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm not well known by the gamers, but I'm pretty well known by the developers, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm. And that's great for us because for Game Wisdom, I think we generally view more towards enthusiasts and designers than we are the regular gamers. What do you think, Ken?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like we talk more about looking critical analysis of multiple works. So I think that's more of our edge.
Yep. And so we got a lot of topics to discuss today. So to begin with, Ernest, for as you said, for people who may not be aware of who you are, could you give us like a brief introduction of, you know, who you are and what your impact towards the game industry has been?
Sure. I got started as a programmer. I actually came out of the electronics industry in Silicon Valley in the 1980s. And I got into the game industry in 89 and began as a programmer and was a programmer for 3 years and then got an opportunity to do game design. Mm-hmm. Went to Electronic Arts and became a game designer there working on the Madden NFL game. So I designed the first Madden that I used a CD-ROM. I didn't design the first Madden ever, but mm-hmm. the first one that used a CD-ROM device, and stayed on the Madden team for the next 6 years, working on, you know, the upgrades, updates, and became an audio-video producer there because we had the CD, and I was one of the few people that actually knew how they worked at that time. Mm-hmm. We had to get a lot of audio and video, and suddenly I was the video guy. So I wrote all the play-by-play for John Madden and his broadcasting partner at the time, Pat Summerall, and mm-hmm. Worked on recording and processing that stuff. And then after a while, I got sort of tired of football. I'd said everything I had to say about football, and I moved to England for a job at Bullfrog Productions, mm-hmm. which Electronic Arts had recently purchased and which I thought was the most innovative game studio in the world at that time. Yeah. You know, Populous, Magic Carpet, Power Monger, Dungeon Keeper, of course, and mm-hmm. so on. So I was really excited about that opportunity. But that only lasted for a year, unfortunately. And then I was cut loose and became independent and just set up my own consulting company. And here I am, sort of 13 years later, still teaching and consulting and writing and doing, you know, a variety of things. But along the way, I also set up the International Game Developers Association because in the 1994 freakout over Mortal Kombat, the U.S. Congress just absolutely lost its collective shit and you know, hauled the game industry up on the carpet and said, you know, we're going to censor you guys if you don't do something about this. And that was when the ESRB was set up, the rating system in the United States. But I felt as if the trade association, what's now called the ESA, was really only speaking for the publishers. They were not speaking mm-hmm. for indies. They were not speaking for individual developers. And I felt like we needed somebody fighting our corner as mm-hmm. as individual developers. And so I said, you know, we need not a trade association, not a union, but a professional society. Something that, like the Association for the Computing Machinery or the American Bar Association, mm-hmm. you know, something that advances the skills and interests of the members and, you know, helps them out as individuals in all sorts of ways and fights their corner politically. Mm-hmm. So that I set that up in 1994, you know, along with a lot of other people who gave a lot of help. I mean, I didn't do it all by myself, but I was the one who mm-hmm. sort of had the idea for it. Ran it for 2.5 years, at which time I was pretty exhausted because I was doing Madden for EA at the same mm-hmm. time and, you know, and handed it over. And it's just kind of gone on from strength to strength since then. So that's, you asked for a short introduction. I'm afraid that isn't one. Anyway, that's what I do. And along the way, I started doing some teaching. I picked up a PhD in interactive storytelling. And now I'm a part-time professor at a university in Sweden. So,
and definitely a lot to digest over there. But I do want to just start with the IGA. I think that it is incredible that you found this in 1994. As you said, it was really in response to Congress, the whole violent games controversy at that time. And it's very interesting because I remember from 80s to most of 90s, the video game industry was looked at, you know, as this like little niche thing. People were still treating it as something that wasn't going to last. Pop culture called us the geeks, the nerds, and all that. And we really didn't see mainstream acceptance until the early thousands. So it's very interesting how you decided to found it then, as you said, in response to the Mortal Kombat outcry, and just see how things have grown over 20 years. I mean, even just at that 10-year gap from 94 to 04, we just saw a lot of movement towards mainstream acceptance.
Yeah, I think, you know, the single biggest thing that has really been good for us has been the growth of casual games.
Mm-hmm.
Because now we have a generation of people who have grown up playing games. You know, we have people who can say, well, you know, I was a kid during the 90s and I didn't turn into a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm happy for, you know, to have my kids play games, and, you know, I'm going to watch them and make sure they don't turn into serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that has helped, and the fact that simply a much broader demographic of people are playing the games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we have games like Farmville that are massively, massively popular among mm-hmm. middle-aged women.
Yeah.
You know, that is all to the good. And, you know, sort of, you know, old-school hardcore gamers are kind of complaining, and then, you know, who are these newcomers, you know, oh, they're changing our beloved games, it's not going to be the same anymore, mm-hmm. and so on. And you know, the reality is, yes, it is, we are still going to have games for hardcore gamers, because mm-hmm. we know they spend a lot of money, they're yeah. out there, but it's, you know, it's changing people's opinions, and you know, we're starting to see gamers elected to Congress.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, it's crazy.
But it was tough in those early days. It was tough for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. We were, as you say, we were small, we were insignificant, we had zero political clout. You know, we had zero star power. Mm-hmm. I mean, Hollywood has already fought this years ago, but Hollywood has a lot of star power. And, you know, if somebody gets online and tweets, you know, somebody like Harrison Ford,
mm-hmm.
you know, if Harrison Ford tweets about movie censorship, tens of millions of people are going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have that, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do have people like, you know, Molyneux and Blazinski and, you know, Mark Cerny and so on, but mm-hmm. but they don't, you know, not that many sort of rank and file gamers actually know who these people are.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
I think Japanese developers are probably more well known. You know,
that's yeah, that's a very interesting phenomenon. The Japanese game industry works in a very different way,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, and they do have this kind of cult of personality around people like, you know, Miyamoto and.
Mm-hmm.
And so on that we've just never really managed to do, or at least that's not part of the whole kind of gamer ethos in the U.S.
Yeah, and that sort of goes back to a post I was talking about the other week in terms of game journalism and how we really are an industry that's sort of split between, you know, the regular gamers, casual gamers, even the enthusiasts, and then we have designers. And how a lot of stuff that, like, we talk about on Game Wisdom, like, a casual gamer probably wouldn't be interested in understanding about camera systems or game design, but game designers will be interested in that stuff. And as you said, Ernest, it's kind of weird how the industry really doesn't have, like, superstars in the same sense that we see in other industries, and how sort of the Japanese game development has become that way. Like, as you said, a lot of people know Miyamoto, Kojima, etc. But when we look at, you know, American or even European names, the list is very narrow instead.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And it's partly because I think publishers don't see any benefit in pushing these names. Mm-hmm. You know, you may recall, I don't know how far back your history goes, but Electronic Arts was originally set up with this kind of metaphor that game dev teams, which were small at the time, you know, mm-hmm. 3 to 5 people, would be treated like rock stars.
Yeah, exactly.
And that they, you know, they the packaging even looked a little bit like an LP.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a picture of the dev team on every package and so forth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked. up until the point when people started wanting to get paid like rock stars. And also, of course, the teams began to get bigger and bigger, and it began sort of unwieldy. And Electronic Arts finally said, okay, we're going to drop this idea. But part of it was that they did not see any percentage in encouraging developers to believe that they were important. For EA, they would much rather keep the money themselves. So,
exactly.
You know, that is one of the things that has kind of tended to suppress this. Whereas in Japan, I don't know, it seems to work a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Well, we do have one giant superstar, which is, you know, Gabe Newell. I think he has a lot of clout within.
Well, we have a lot more than Gabe Newell, really. Mm-hmm. If you start listing them, people like Peter Molyneux and Cliff Bleszinski and John Romero and so on, whose names are very well known. Now, Gabe Newell has proven to be a very shrewd businessman. Mm-hmm. In addition to, you know, his design contribution. So things like setting up Steam, you know, that was a very, very shrewd move. But yeah, you know, I think a lot of gamers don't care all that much who made them.
Definitely. I mean, especially when you look at like the Call of Duty franchise and how that's split between two different development houses.
Yeah.
And as you said, it can't think of, you know, the guy behind Call of Duty. I think of Infinity Ward or Treyarch. Well, Treyarch before they got, I think, disbanded this year. Mm-hmm. And we're more known for the game studios than we are the designers. I mean, PC gamers probably know who Sid Meier is, but the console fans who probably enjoyed XCOM probably know more as just Firaxis as opposed to Sid Meier.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's right. And, you know, I have long felt that, speaking as a game designer myself, of course, we would benefit from having a cult of personality and a certain amount of hero worship. But, you know, it's also kind of not entirely the way we work. You know, in Hollywood, if you are a film director, you're pretty much God on the set.
Yeah.
And you can point to somebody and say, you're fired because I don't like your face. You know, and that's just tough. That's the way things are. Game development is a more collaborative. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not unionized. We're not paid terribly well.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, people are in game development for the opportunity to make a creative contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that means is that a designer can't simply say, this is my vision and my vision alone. They actually have to try to incorporate people's suggestions or learn how to turn them down gently.
Mm-hmm.
And say, you know, we're going to build this thing together and put it together into a single thing. And so you don't have somebody who's kind of like Francis Ford Coppola, where you can say, okay, I can see that this is a Coppola movie,
mm-hmm.
or a Martin Scorsese movie or a Spielberg movie, where there's a distinct visual style that says, yes, this is absolutely this guy's vision. Games, for the most part, are not that personal.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with you completely on that. As we said, like, for the studio, yes, like, a studio can have a vision, but when we get down to the individual level, a lot of people simply don't know or don't care, you know, who are these people who make these games?
Yeah, you know, and it's not a completely straightforward thing. Who exactly did what?
Yeah.
You know, in when you look at a movie and you look at the camera work, you know, and the style of it and so on, you know, you know that is something that has come out of the director's mind.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the lighting and the shading and the audio and so on in a video game,
mm-hmm.
is that the designer? Well, probably not. That's actually the lead artist or the art director.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the designer may have sort of said in a very general way,
mm-hmm.
you know, okay, I want this to be dark and moody, you know, but it's the lead artist who actually made it happen. So it's an interesting issue.
And if you look at it too, like in this in cinema, the director also takes all the blame if the movie is bad, but takes all the credit if the movie is good.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the game industry is a lot different. So, you know, if a game is bad, it's blame the company that created it and not the actual director himself.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Or like, I mean, they critique, but you don't really notice that kind of stuff. And I think that people like cinematographers and cinema and stuff like that are only really recognized by people within the industry themselves.
Right.
Over, you know, normal people. I mean, sometimes they will, like, enthusiasts will. But
yeah, right.
And going back to what we said regarding, like, Japanese developers sort of being like the heroes or the people that are more known, I would say someone like Hideo Kojima has sort of risen to that status, like with how his games have sort of gone that more cinematography route, you know, being very cinematic. He's got like 30-40 minute cutscenes in a lot of his games now. And he's probably one of the few developers that when you play one of his games, you can pretty much say, yeah, this is a game for Kojima.
You could see, like, there's a lot of auteurs, like Suda51 is another one you can really sense his style.
Mm. Well, one of the things that of course, indie development has done, and the growth of middleware, which, you know, middleware is not all that well known to the ordinary gamer, but within the industry, its impact has actually been huge, because it's meant that it's possible for much smaller teams to make games, and that has made a certain amount of auteur work possible, you know, so artistic works like Jonathan Blow's or Jason Rohr's work that are really the work of a single individual are possible now in a way that they would not have been possible a while ago and are not possible on really large scale projects.
Exactly.
So we do have our auteurs, but again, you know, that's a really tiny niche right now. I mean, ask how many gamers have you know, heard of Jonathan Blow, and it's not going to be a long list.
Yeah, the indie market has really just grown, but it's still very separate from the mainstream. I know that Sony has been pushing for more indie developers for the PS4, which I find that to be very interesting to see just how that's going to take off. But as you said, Ernest, like, while, you know, games like Gone Home or Braid or even The Castle Doctrine may be known towards enthusiasts and developers, chances are the people, like, as we said, who grew up or enjoy, like, Farmville or just play on the consoles will probably just give you, like, a puzzle, like, who the hell are these people?
Yeah. And, you know, that's all right. I mean, you know, there are small art house movies.
Yeah.
And every now and then somebody makes a small art house movie that blows some people's minds, and they have a significant effect. Or, you know, you get somebody who has been a very successful, plain old kind of commercial filmmaker like Spielberg was for a long time. And then he decides, okay, I'm going to do a prestige project that really shows what I'm about and does Schindler's List, you know, and okay, you know, he did Howard the Duck, but then he did Schindler's List, you know, and so, you know, he began to show what he was capable of, really. And that, I think that will happen for us as well, you know, that, who knows? It's very possible that somebody like Blazinski will say, okay, I'm tired of making, you know, grimy urban shooters. You know, I'm going to make something beautiful and esoteric just for the fun of it. That could be very cool if it happens. So.
By the way, just nerd out really quick. I think it was George Lucas, not Spielberg, for Howard the Duck.
Oh, I do apologize. Yes, okay.
Right. I mean, it was still awful. Shame whoever put it on it, but I think it was put on his mantle.
Now, Ken, I think you were going to say something like a minute ago?
Yes, I was going to say something about, you know, the iconic status of Japanese developers just because they've been there for so long. And I feel like there's definitely developers that have a lot of weight when they actually speak. Like Kenji Inafune, when he said that there's stagnation in the, you know, Japanese game industry in terms of design. There's a lot of people that was raging at him, but a lot of people agreed with him too, because they're seeing, at least in the Western eyes, that exactly what's happening. Looking at like what happened with Japanese RPGs and these giant Titan companies falling into really, really safe ideas, you know?
Yeah.
But I fully remember what I was really going to say. That was part of what I was going to say. What I really was going to say was, talking about the concept of art tours, and like a style and look, I feel like there's companies now that have tropes that people know. Like Ubisoft has all these games with, you have to climb up something and then you get like a waypoint and vision. And they've done it in so many games that people like now know that this is an Ubisoft game because of that stupid trope. So that's their artistic, like, you know, it's like, I mean, it's lazy, but it's something they're known for. And now all our games that do that, it's an Ubisoft game.
Yeah. And, you know, and you can do that as long as people are happy with it and are enjoying it. But it does mean that you belong to a certain kind of thing. And if you don't grow beyond that, then, you know, it's not particularly good for you, frankly. I don't think it's harmful to the industry necessarily, but, you know, you become stagnant.
Yeah. And by the way, you did bring up an interesting name, Romero. I'd like to actually bring him up later when we talked about virtual reality, because he said something really baseless recently.
Mm.
Okay.
You know? All right. But he says stuff like that all the time, though, throughout all of his history. I feel like he's a man of controversy.
Yep, and we'll talk about VR and the crowdfunding movement probably next. Now, one thing that I wanted to go back to that you mentioned way at the start, Ernest, was regarding the ESRB. And this is something that I find very interesting. I just want to get your thoughts on this. In terms of, like, what do you think about the ESRB's contribution to the game industry? Because, as we said, they started out essentially as the rating system, and that was sort of a way of appeasing Congress at the time. But in today's market, it sort of seems like they're becoming less and less important, because, as we said, with the rise of the indies and the auteur movement there, a lot of the new developers don't need to get their games rated or even care about that stuff because they're not aimed at that mainstream market. So I just want to get your thoughts on sort of how the ESRB has grown and changed over the years.
Well, yes, the ESRB was absolutely essential to stopping these threats to censor games. You know, games did not have First Amendment protection. I know that's hard to believe because, you know, and I know that they are an expressive medium, just like, you know, painting and music and literature. But the reality is they did not have First Amendment protection when these issues blew up. So, you know, there was an explicit overt threat from Congress that they would censor video games unless the industry did something about it. So the ESRB, you know, covered our behinds, basically. Mm-hmm. It you know, it established this system and said, and it met the effectively the requirements of Congress to do this. But yes, you know, there's no question that now that we have electronic distribution or digital distribution, you know, now that you don't always just buy things at a store and so forth, it's very possible to do an end run around the ESRB. And so its relevance has declined a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, its relevance has also declined a little bit simply because Congress is no longer that concerned about such things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the moral panic is not over yet entirely, but it's fading.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm in favor of what the ESRB does. The consumer is entitled to know what they're buying. I think that's, you know, that's reasonably fair. It is not as badly designed or as constraining as the Motion Picture Association system is.
Mm-hmm.
The MPAA system is done by kind of three anonymous people, and it produces some very odd results. You know, it's very clear that they're much more okay with violence than they are with nudity, for example. And, you know, it's... It also means that film companies, deliberately insert certain content in order to get an R rating because less than an R rating is a kiss of financial death.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of distorts the artist's vision. Okay, well, we'll have to put in some breasts because we're not getting an R rating.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so quick, you know, find a way to include some breasts because we need an R rating. That hasn't really happened in the game industry. You know, that we're not, I don't think there are that many people who actually go out of their way to screw around with their content in order to get a particular ESRB rating. And that's good. And, you know, as the ESRB's significance continues to decline, then we will simply go on making what we believe is the right thing to make for whatever it is we're working on. So, sorry, long answer to a simple question, but, you know, they remain very valuable to us because we can point to them and say, yes, we do labeling.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so I would say that they are essential to our continued political safety, but, you know, they're not as critical as they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I think the trend is actually the opposite of the MPAA. Like, I mean, I think a lot of films try to make things PG-13 because making it rated R is the kiss of death in the opposite direction. I feel like
movies are starting to get...
Look, Expendables, right? The first one was blood, people were getting torn apart. Second movie, more people, PG-13. Or all these hero films that are pretty close to violence. Like, Dark Knight, that was PG-13, and it wouldn't be as successful as it was rated R.
Was Man
Even
of
though the movie
Steel
should have been rated R.
Rated R?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we have seen an absolutely enormous number of movies that are clearly aimed at kids in, like, the last 5 or 6 years. The explosive growth of the superhero movie.
Yeah.
You know, there simply were not that many superhero movies in the 2000s.
Or especially in the 90s.
Yeah. Or in the 90s, yeah. Well,
geek culture is mainstream now. Like, geek culture and nerd culture is becoming more mainstream and more, not as, what would you call it, like, condemned as in the past.
Yeah.
I think also perspectives on people that enjoy kind of like niche things or games are seen less like, you know, basement dwellers and like people with like interests.
I think you're right there, but there's still a strong connection, particularly with comic books to children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there's definitely going to be this thing. So for anything, you know, funny books, whatever they call them, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's always going to be, I think that's beyond the norm, is going to be seen as some sort of weird fetish or neuroses to a degree. And, like, the concept of a man-child becoming thrown around all the time, that people are not acting according to their age because they do like something like comics or something like, you know, video games. But, I mean, you could say that by anything. Like, how would people that like pop art? You're going to break into that era? Like, where do you draw the line?
Yeah, that's kind of a long and complicated conversation, actually.
Yeah, we probably don't have the time for that today.
I mean, let me just simplify it, though. I'm like, you shouldn't be living through other people's, like, eyes and stuff like that. I mean, you live in your own skin and you make your own choices. People's opinion of you shouldn't be judged by your own, like, your action should be judged upon by them. And I think that people are becoming more aware of that.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, you know, when I was in junior high school, I was in junior high school so long ago that it was actually called junior high school. Mm-hmm. I got a lot of crap from people because I listened to classical music. So, you know, other people's entertainment choices are kind of a constant sort of source of discussion. Oh my God, I can't believe they listen to country and western. But yes, certainly, you know, the kind of geek enthusiasm to become a lot more mainstream. And at the same time, video games have actually gotten less geeky. That is to say, you know, we have a lot of games now that are not actually about blowing up aliens.
That's
a good thing too.
Exactly. I mean, I see that that there's always that argument to always say grow up whenever they see someone playing a game or reading a comic or doing some sort of art or whatever. I think that's a super weak and very, I don't know, uneducated criticism to people like that. Like, where does that line draw? When are you actually grown up?
I've railed for a long time against what I see as sort of prolonged adolescence. In the game industry, you know, it is not okay to tell people to grow up just because they happen to be playing a video game. But I do think that the game industry really kind of needs to get over the tits and ass fantasy thing. I mean, I'm not saying to ban it. I'm not saying to censor it. I don't think it will ever disappear entirely. I wouldn't want it to be suppressed. I just think, you know, we need to move beyond that. And that's one of the reasons we haven't really talked about this as a topic of conversation. But I set up a Facebook page and also a Pinterest wall called Heroic Women to Inspire Game Designers. And I just list real famous women who actually did amazing things on this. And use them as opportunities for game designers to learn about real women who did really extremely cool things, and use them as opportunities to create protagonists who aren't just barely dressed women in chainmail bikinis.
Yeah, I wonder what would happen if the fantasy novelists of the start didn't actually make that kind of trope. What would happen if they made all their barbarian women like covered in clad armor and never shown? I wonder how things would have changed to RNG, because it looks like we have a lot of inspiration from that era, you know, Conan Barbarian and all that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know. It is legitimate to have people who are barely wearing any armor if they're actually based on historical peoples who didn't have any armor. It's like, okay, you know, the Mongolians, for example, they didn't wear metal armor. They didn't have the kind of metalsmithing that was necessary to do it. And so, you know, I mean, Conan is a barbarian. Yeah. So, you know, he wears a loincloth. Okay, that's, you know, Conan does not know how to make plate mail. So, But, so that's all right. You know, I think that's legitimate.
Yeah. But when you have like games taking place like 2,000 years in the future, then the argument kind of falls apart when you have women walking around in chainmail bikinis, you know, fighting robots in the year 3,000.
Sometimes I feel like because we have such a large range of developers now, of, you know, large and small, we're doing better representation of women at least in the West. But I feel like there's still like problem with designers in the East, or like in the Japanese market, where they still like whatever they can to make those really
scantily
clad women. Their designs are based around like, all right, well, we have all this armor, but let's cut out this chest area and the stomach area, wide open for attack. I'm like, so I see that a lot more.
And like the Korean free to play market, I think, is also pretty bad.
And you talk to developers, you hear their interviews, and they always say like, well, they want to see something pretty in their hours of play. I'm like, well, that doesn't help. All you're doing is perpetuating, you know, the stereotype, and you're continuing it on forever.
All right. So we're going to try to move along pretty quickly because I know we're all very busy today. So one topic that I know, Ken, that you're interested in asking Ernest about is, I guess, the reawakening of VR with the game industry and, of course, with the Oculus Rift. So if you have any questions for him, feel free.
Well, I guess the first question is, what is your general opinion of where virtual reality kind of came from, and what do you think of technology now?
Well, virtual reality is kind of, you know, based on this very long-standing fantasy. You know, it goes back to stories by Ray Bradbury that were, you know, written in the 40s and 50s about the possibility of having a totally immersive environment in which you experience some kind of an alternate reality. And when Ray Bradbury, you know, wrote his story The Veldt, he imagined a room with projectors that were showing things on the walls. Or in Fahrenheit 451, there were entire walls that were TV screens. That's actually not all that practical. And so, you know, we move on to having head mount displays and things like that. That, I think, has enormous potential for certain kinds of applications. You know, it's extremely valuable for people to be able to experience these completely immersive environments for certain kinds of things. And to be perfectly honest, I think that training may actually be even more important than entertainment as an opportunity for those sorts of things. So, for example, if you are experiencing the role of a first responder, you're a paramedic, and you are arriving on the scene of a place where a bomb has gone off. You know, there's half a dozen people who are lying around in various states of physical distress, injury, and you have to very quickly assess the situation and, you know, triage these people and figure out who to treat first and so on. A VR environment is going to be extremely valuable for that because it gives you 360-degree kind of immersion over those sorts of things. And, of course, it will be very fun for certain kinds of entertainment, absolutely for, you know, extremely immersive movies. You know, we have tried by other means to make movies very immersive. You know, people love IMAX films because you have this huge screen that gives you all this peripheral vision. You know, the film formats have gotten wider and wider and wider, you know, going starting with the old square 16 millimeter film way back when, and, you know, moving on to something like, you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey and Super Panavision, which I think required three separate projectors just to put it on the screen. So, you know, people are very interested in this sort of immersion. And I've been following VR for quite a long time. I had an opportunity to work on a VR project in about year 2000. And at that time, the head mount displays were $10,000 a pop, you know. So it was an extremely specialized, very expensive, limited thing. And, you know, the only kind of consumer version was, of course, the Virtual Boy. You know, it just was not there. It was kind of a cute experiment. But
set us back.
Yeah, it actually did. It really did, because, you know, it was too soon, and people said, "Well, this is this is clearly garbage."
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm absolutely delighted at the progress that we've made from $10,000 head mount displays to, you know, to $300 head mount displays.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why we have kind of renaissance in virtual realities, because the first problem was a good head mount display, something that's cost effective and believable. So now we have like that, you know, one-to-one tracking for like rotation and motion. And now we also have that cost down. I think then a lot of other companies can then make supplemental, you know, peripherals for it, you know, such as the STEM controllers or the Omni treadmills and all that kind of crazy stuff to really get that sense of presence and immersion that people always dreamed about, like I said, in the past for a change in environment, you know, that's not actually real.
Right. Now, I have used an Oculus Rift prototype, and I think, you know, it's still to some degree dependent on the speed of the CPU. Because I found that it was making me kind of motion sick. So, you know, it was not entirely free of lag. But that is not necessarily the Oculus Rift's fault. I mean,
they fixed that, by the way, with the developer's kit too.
Oh, uh-huh.
So they have a low persistence display, so you don't have the motion blur when you turn your head anymore.
I'm delighted to hear it.
So the motion sickness pretty much has been cut all the way gone. It's like gone now, the motion sickness. For a lot of people that said they had it, it's completely gone with the low display.
I've got to play another one then, because that's been the Achilles heel as far as I've been concerned personally. I mean, I have a fairly weak stomach anyway, and so I'm absolutely delighted to hear it, and you know, look forward to the opportunity to play with a newer version.
I just got my DK2 last week, and I've been doing some development on it. It's pretty awesome so far. This one, instead of working as an infinite display, they have two modes for it now. They have direct mode, so instead of, you know, replicating or like cloning your screen and taking out processing power, it goes directly to the head-mount display, which is really neat. There's also, because of they have a like, pentagon display, like it's not squares anymore, it's like hexagons, I guess, or pentagons or whatever. So, I think it's hexagons actually, the shape, because they're using Note 3 as their screen now. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot less screen door effect too. I'm sure you saw you could really tell it was a screen before, but now it's a lot less chance of you, unless you really focus, you see the screen door effect. But here it's pretty much been mostly eliminated, but not going to completely eliminated. Right. That's the next version, the rumored next version is 1440. That's the consumer version.
Wow.
So there's a lot of, and that's going to be pretty much eliminate that screen door effect. And, you know, hopefully that with the CV also will add a positional tracking solution too. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, you know, I don't actually know quite what's in the Rift and what's in the plans for the future, but, you know, one of the reasons that the Kinect works as well as it does as an input device is because it has a lot of CPU power built into the Kinect itself. And so it's not relying on the game console to do all that processing. You know, I think if the Rift had its own CPU or its own card or whatever, you know, I'm not exactly sure what would be required. Anyway, if you could offload more of that graphic processing power to something that was Rift dedicated, then I think that would only help. But of course, it does drive up the price.
Well, though, I guess the one problem with the Rift is that at least the creator of the Rift, Paul Merluckey, says that it should be 75 frames per second, whatever you're playing, or you're going to lose the concept of you know, consistency. You know, you need to have that level. That's the optimal level. With a certain refresh rate. Right now it's like 75, but it should be 90 hertz is their goal, refresh rate.
Yeah.
For like, believability. So, I think that they're getting ever closer to the concept of presence. And I'm super excited for the next year because I'm going to get they just released a new treadmill. There's two people that make omnidirectional treadmills. One's called the Omni, and it uses special shoes. And you have like a non-friction pad in the bottom, and it's curved so you don't fall over.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all plastic, no moving parts, so it's cheaper. And that was the first one. It got a huge funding on Kickstarter. And the next one was July, this month. And it's called the Virtualizer. It's Austrian made. It's made of metal. And you don't need special shoes, just socks. It's a flat surface. Mm-hmm. And they have a contraption, like a harness, so you can jump up and down and crouch and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Along with a solution for like the head-mounted display, because right now, even the new consumer version of the device is probably going to be wired. So you're probably going to need something like above your head to make sure you don't get tangled. So I am all about becoming an early adopter of all these crazy contraptions they have coming out. Because there's wireless controllers, there's actually hand controllers out that can replicate your fingers called a control VR. Mm-hmm. And there's just so many amazing things coming out, and it's great time to be in game development for that kind of stuff.
You know, these things also have a lot of applications that kind of an ordinary consumer developer isn't necessarily going to think of. There's a device called a Caren, C-A-R-E-N machine. They're comparatively rare, but they also are treadmills that are balanced on top of a gimbaled platform that can angle up and down and left and right. So in addition to being on a treadmill, it can it can make you walk uphill or downhill and various other kinds of things. And to use it, you are in fact in a harness, but you can wear VR gear at the same time. And one of the applications for this is to teach people to regain their balance who have suffered major lower limb injuries, and they're learning to walk with artificial limbs or with one artificial limb. You know, children who have balance problems and things like that. And so there's a enormous potential for rehabilitation, sports medicine. Accident injury rehabilitation. And of course, the military is very interested in all these kinds of things because they get a lot of people who get blown up and need a lot of rehabilitation. So yeah, these are very exciting. The extent to which this stuff will catch on to the consumer, you know, I have said for a long time that the basic issue is how much space in your house you're prepared to dedicate to it. And, you know, there are people who are willing to set up a race car cockpit in their house and have three big screens and have the steering wheel and the pedals and so on and so forth, you know, and that's fine, but that's probably about 2% of the actual, or 5% maybe, of the driving sim market.
You know, I've done number,
right. Yeah. Well, so it's clear that you are a serious hardcore enthusiast, and I think they will be out there, doing this also with the treadmills and so forth. But as a percentage of the overall market, you know, it's necessarily going to be a niche, and that's okay. You can make a lot of money out of a niche. But you know, it would be foolish to assume that this is going to become the general way that people play.
I think, yeah, that's definitely not going to be true, but I think virtual reality actually has a really good shot of becoming more mainstream just because of that gigantic purchase by Facebook, $2 billion. I mean, they already had $137 million from private investors, Oculus. I mean, a lot of people really went crazy when Facebook bought. It's like, why would Facebook buy Oculus Rift? Like, they were like the Valve of VR. They wanted them to like be independent forever. But I mean, if you really wanted to get mainstream, a company like that with that kind of connections, that's what you need as a partner, and someone that's not directly competing against you, someone that's kind of like not even analogous to you.
It's great to, you know, to have a lot of cash. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And have a connection to a very, very large number of people, which Facebook is going to provide them with. You know, that's great. So when Oculus, you know, releases a press release, you know, it's going to pass through Facebook now instead of just being their own. And right. Suddenly it's going to get just a heck of a lot more attention from the world press than it would have otherwise. That is absolutely the case. I'm just, you know, concerned about particular kinds of practicalities. Mm-hmm. So for example, VR is not the right way to play Madden. You know, Madden is best played with four different people in one room, you know, drinking beer and eating chips and giving each other the high five and smack talk and all the rest of that kind of stuff. It's a very social thing. And, you know, and you can't give somebody the high five if you can't actually see them. So, you know, the VR is necessarily isolating, and that's why it works so well, right? It's because it takes you out of the place where you are. You know, you can't play a shooter game and keep an eye on your 3-year-old at the same time with VR. You can do that with a screen because you can hit pause and turn around and see what's going on. But with VR, it's a little more difficult. So it's just one of those things that it will work for certain kinds of games and certain kinds of applications brilliantly. There are others for which it won't. You know, there's no point in playing Farmville in VR, right? I mean, you could make
it. Could.
You could. Yeah, right.
You could do it.
But, you know, yeah. And, you know, so it's enormously exciting. There's no question about that. And I look forward to it. I just think that, you know, if you're not smart about the applications you choose for it, you're going to waste time and energy.
Well, to me, it actually leads me into what I want to discuss, because a lot of backlash against the Oculus because of the big push for motion controls back in the day with the Wii. Mm-hmm. And everyone was like, motion controls are everything. And people were like, I just want to sit on my couch. I don't want to stand up and throw my arms around. You know what I mean?
Right.
So there's
right.
people that just hate alternate controls. Like, I want to sit and use the same controller that's been done for the last 30 years. You know, that's the way it should be forever.
It's just, right.
But I mean, that, I don't like that kind of stagnation. I like what kind of VR offered, but they're just lumping it in anyways with it because it's an alternate control type to a degree. I mean, it's not an alternate view type, but you know what I mean? An alternate type.
Yeah. From
what
they're and used you don't, to. You know, you don't absolutely have to force people to turn their head more than they want to. I mean, you know, that sort of issue. Okay, you know, I want to see what's going on to my left, so I turn my head to the left instead of twiddling a joystick and looking at a screen. I actually turn my head to the left. Well, you know, there's an important distinction, and as somebody who actually works with this stuff, you know this even better than I do, between looking to the left and turning to the left, right? You know,
right.
It's one thing to peek around a corner to the left, and VR is absolutely great for that. When you're steering, you know, obviously you don't want to keep your head twisted to the left indefinitely. So you know, you've got to manage these things, and all these things will get worked out.
Right.
And it's just a, you know, I think people who are saying, oh, I don't want motion control, therefore I don't want VR, are missing the point. You know, that's, you know, we will find the sweet spot for VR. There's no question about that. You know, and we'll make a few mistakes along the way, and there'll be some, you know, some things that people will screw up. But, you know, we are right now getting this stuff worked out, and my gosh, it's so much better than it used to be.
I think that's the beauty, by the way, is that the way that it worked is through Kickstarter, they got a huge amount of enthusiasts and developers to come onto the project, get these developers kits, start making things to start showing the validity of VR, right? And they still are making stuff. They're still fixing things. And when the Dev Kit 2 hit, all the games broke. All the games broke because they needed a, because the camera got attached, right? And because of the camera, if you didn't have a, you know, the module or the SDK that was supported at the time, a week ago, then it wouldn't work. I mean, they've released another version, like a quick fix for this week, where you can turn off the camera and all the controls, and there's like a legacy mode for TK1. But at one point, there's just no games. People just got it, like, I can't run anything. I'll have to make something. Dang. But that was the part. But you know, it's definitely got a lot of growing pains. But I'm saying when the consumer version comes out, there will be a ton of applications, a ton of backwards compatibility. Mm. And I think that to me, the people that hate on the virtual reality on the Oculus Rift are people that either that hate, you know, changing their ways, or there's three, or they hate Facebook, or mostly, and this is for Josh too, people that haven't tried virtual reality ever, never seen it, never experienced it, and can never see its potential.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are so many people, you know, just kind of blathering on the internet, you know, that will badmouth anything for the sake of badmouthing it. And as a developer, you just really have to learn to ignore those people. You know, if criticism is not constructive, just delete it. Because people, you know, people hating on them for the Facebook thing or just saying, I hate VR, well, then you're clearly not my target audience. Shut up and go away. You know, that's pointless. You know, if somebody has some thoughtful, constructive criticism to make that says, you know, look, VR makes me sick to my stomach, you know, so you're going to have to do something about that, that's a different kind of a thing. But yeah, the haters, just forget them. Just skip it, you know. It's an interesting thing. Oculus has done something extremely smart by making these dev kits easily available. I was the person who was responsible for buying dev kits for, this is going a long way back, for the Sega Saturn for Electronic Arts developers, right?
Nice.
So I had to buy these kits and send them out to our developers, and they were broken. They were terrible. The manuals were badly translated from the Japanese. One Saturn dev kit was $15,000, and the higher end one was $25,000. Mm. Now that, you know, multiply that by however many programmers you have, you know, and that totally put that beyond the reach of most people. You know, only a company like EA could even begin to supply those dev kits. And where's the Sega Saturn now? You know, I mean, you know, so, cause EA just said, screw it, these are not worth it. And people, the programmers would come back to us and they would say, this is broken. It literally does not work. And we'd go back to Sega and say, guys, you sent us a busted one. And they would say, tough, too bad. You brought it. Seriously.
That's evil.
So, you know, it was so evil. And, you know, then Microsoft came along with Xbox, and they had a much more developer-friendly attitude about everything, and it you know, didn't hurt that the Xbox was kind of a PC that had been squished into a console-shaped box. But you know, they were very pro-developers. You know, and you've got that funny video of Steve Ballmer going, "Developers, developers, developers, developers," you know, which is really funny, but it was true. And Oculus has been that smart as well. You know, they have said, "We're going to put this in the hands of as many people as we possibly can. We're not going to charge $10,000 for it. And have at it, guys. Good luck."
Well, he said, and
that's
too,
so smart.
He said in an interview, too, because he got bought by Facebook, they have the ability now to sell the Oculus consumer at cost. So that's really crazy. The goal is to get it into people's hands, not just to make a profit off it anymore.
Right, right. Yeah, so that, yeah, and that's that. Right. That's really huge.
So, yeah, that's going to be a pretty exciting when that technology comes out and people can actually try it. And I think, I mean, we see some applications now that are pretty interesting, like you said earlier about like simulation stuff, but people have used it for pain relief recently. Dentists have actually employed the DK1 for pain relief for kids. Chuck E. Cheese made a grab the cash virtual reality game, which they did take. They recently discontinued because epileptic seizure concepts, you know, danger is there.
Right.
Things would flash. They're like, oh, God.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, because getting people's hands, be able to try it out, make it readily available to the public, I think that's when it'll actually take a real hook to being just a niche thing to being a semi-niche thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the U.S. Army is also using VR for pain relief. They particularly for burn treatments, which are extremely painful. They put you in the VR headset. They give, you know, put the earphones on, and suddenly you're in an ice world, zooming around, throwing snowballs at penguins, and it you actually need less morphine. So that is, you know, that's really huge.
Yeah. So I think that's a great thing. Just all that kind of potential. People always forget that. All they see is Facebook bought it, or right, that it's, oh man, emotion control. Dang.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I hopefully we'll get over that hump and, you know, let people try it out and, you know, spread the gospel per se.
Right.
Before we move on, Ken, you mentioned John Romero earlier in the cast, so something he said about VR.
Oh.
Did you want?
I mean, I guess it was not that big of a deal reading what he said. He pretty much said that VR is a fad. It's not going anywhere. It isolates people. It makes you play, stay in one place. You know what I mean? I'm like, all right, well, don't current games keep you one place too?
Yeah. How long ago did he say that?
A couple weeks ago.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
Nope, just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, right.
It was just like, well, it's a fad. It's nothing. Like, but I've learned this. Whatever John Romero says, it's going to be, it's a fad. It's not a fad.
Right. Yeah.
Next shot is going to be the next breaking thing. Now,
the criticism that it's isolating is legitimate, and so therefore it's going to have to be used in applications where that doesn't matter, and that's fine. You know where you're not trying to high five somebody sitting on the couch next to you. Mm-hmm. But you know, is it a fad? No, I don't think at this point it is. I think, you know, we will find that. And now, you know, the virtual boy, that was a fad.
Yeah,
and
that was a fad.
It was a fad. Well, it was too little too soon. And so that's the kind of thing that, you know, tends to generate a great deal of attention. I mean, heck, there was a motion input device way back in the late 80s called the Bruderbund U-Force.
I know what it is. I know exactly what it is.
Yeah, you know, and that too was a fad.
It looks like what's that game with the battleships? Battleship.
Yes.
Like Battleship. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It sort of roughly detected where your hands were. Yeah. And, you know, so it was very exciting for a moment, and then it disappeared, and that was because it was ahead of its time. But, you know, VR has now arrived at a point where it is genuinely usable at a sensible cost. And no, you know, I disagree with Romero that it is a fad now. It is definitely going somewhere.
Yeah, and I do have to say one more thing, just talking about developers and Oculus support. It's really awesome that, you know, Reddit, you know, Reddit.com,
I know Reddit. I don't look at it much, but.
But they have a subreddit called, you know, Reddit r Oculus, and I go there all the time, like, it's way too much. And, the, you know, Palmer Luckey, the actual developers of the Oculus are on there all the time too. And developers, like the big developers making big projects and stuff like that, like Technolust and Gallery and a bunch of other like big VR games, they're on there too, just all talking and VR evangelists. And they got their little flair, so you know who's who. It's awesome seeing like people having some sort of beef with something. Like example, there was something in the agreement for the Oculus saying that you can only make it through whatever platform Oculus says is okay. And that's actually a vestige from some sort of a contract for like big developers or whatever for trade shows, but they forgot to leave it in. They made a big huff of it, but Paul Malucky directly addressed it, said, took it out. That was a mistake. We didn't mean to do that. You know, thanks for the heads up, that kind of thing. So it's right. Great to see the actual CEO or actual developers from the device come out to people and be like, hey man, how's it going?
Yeah.
We fixed it.
Yeah. Right.
I've never seen that.
Yeah, that kind of, right, that immediate direct connection between the developers and the, when I say developers, I mean the developers of the Oculus and the programmers who are using it, is really great, you know, and that is something that you don't get, unfortunately, with the console industry. You know, some Japanese guy somewhere invent a console and suddenly, boom, it's in your lap. And if you've got a question about it, too bad, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's, again, that kind of level of responsiveness is just enormously valuable for everyone. It will help Oculus. It will also help the people building for it.
Also, they have a hype train they always build up. They usually put tweets out there. Like recently, they put one saying that they dramatically increased performance with our new drivers. I'm like, whoa, what could it be? We don't know. Could it be for a certain engine? Could it be in general? We don't know. So,
right.
Yeah, hype machine.
All right. So with that, let's move on and talk a little bit about game design. Because, again, we're sort of moving pretty quickly. I know this is one of those topics where we could probably break this into, you know, part two, part three, part four cast just on game design alone. But we can at least talk about some of the major points and some interesting conversations here. So I guess my first question for you, Ernest, and this is probably a good toughie as well, is since you've been following the industry now for over 20 years, when someone brings up the topic of what is good game design or what makes a game good or bad or whatever, what do you think about that? Like, what qualifiers do you use to basically say, you know, this game is good, this game is bad, etc.?
Well, you know, there are so many different kinds of both aesthetic and technical things that go into game development that it's, you know, it's extremely difficult to come up with a succinct answer.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's kind of a list of things. And the fact is, it's much easier to identify things that make a game bad than it is to make a game good. You know, a game with awkward or sloppy controls, you know, that's difficult to control. A game with ugly or incompetent artwork or with, you know, badly produced sound, you know, a game that is laggy or that, you know, it clearly experiences technical problems or that is buggy or crashes, you know, all those things make games bad. So what makes a game good is first an absence of crap. So you begin there, right?
That's a good mantra, by the way.
Yeah.
Right. You know, we'll start with an absence of crap. We'll assume that, in fact, that, you know, the game runs fast and smoothly and that its user interface is intuitive and, you know, that it is not unreasonably complicated and not unreasonably hard unless you're Ninja Gaiden and, and then you set out to be unreasonably hard. But then to go, kind of go on from good to great, that's the step that is very, very difficult to make. And for me, one of the key principles of good game design, and actually I did not think this up, I'm quoting from a famous designer named Brian Moriarty, is something called harmony. And harmony is the quality wherein everything just fits together perfectly. You know that everything is all part of the same aesthetic object. And I have seen games in which it was very clear that the people who did the artists who did the shell screens were not the same as the artists who did the in-game art. And they clearly didn't talk to each other. Maybe they hated each other because the styles were radically different and just, you know, it was like, whoa, you know, sudden aesthetic headshot. What did you do to me? Because it doesn't go together, you know, or there's music that is wildly inappropriate for the circumstances that you're in. You know, that is a failure of harmony. Or stuff that tends to break your illusion. Now, some gamers don't care about this. Some gamers are not really into narrative immersion, into being in the world. they're more into like just optimizing the gameplay and you know, squeezing the very last dollar or mm-hmm. or point or, you know, whatever it is that the game is about out of it. And they, you know, they don't care about where you are. But for me, as a player, I'm very much interested in the narrative experience of the game, the world that I'm in. And so, therefore, when there's some horrendous anachronism or there's terrible writing or there's terrible acting, you know, that, again, just yanks me straight out of my fantasy and says, oh, you're making something, you're playing something that was made by a bozo. So, yeah, you know, first, an absence of crap. Second, harmony. Mm-hmm. And that's harmony is one of the very few sort of terms that is totally cross genre. You know, it doesn't matter if we're talking about first person shooters or if we're talking about, you know, a puzzle game on a mobile phone. If it has harmony, you can feel it.
Yeah.
Everything works together beautifully. So those are the things that I encourage people to look for. You know, just one is sort of raw competence. Mm-hmm. skill at executing the game, and then having this quality that it all feels like it's part of a single thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is all great points. I love the idea of like that concept of harmony, as you mentioned, because it is one of those things that I think a lot of developers do struggle with. Like, we see a lot in AAA games where it sort of feels like game was designed by committee. Or I know, Ken and I, we talked about this on previous casts, you know, like the whole focus group type design where the game is just keep changing and alter, you know, based on, you know, whatever someone else says. So the vision gets muddled. I think that's a really, I guess, antithesis to harmony is when that happens.
I think that curses many industries, though, the concept of playing it safe, seeing what, you know, the lowest common denominator, all that kind of stuff like that. And I've seen so many games get ruined or artists' visions get ruined because of focus groups.
Mm-hmm. That's a slightly different issue. But yes, it is another phenomenon. You know, mm-hmm. certainly there's a phenomenon in statistics called convergence towards the mean, which is the more data you gather, the more it tends to eventually converge around a neutral, a mean point, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you start with somebody's completely outrageous vision,
mm-hmm.
which if you imagine this is a graph, it's way out towards one end or another.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the more people you add to that vision, the more it will tend to coalesce towards a safe, neutral middle, you know, and all the weird, spiky strangeness will get sanded down, so to speak. And yeah, that is necessarily a problem with, you know, with design by committee and even more so with focus groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, focus groups, I am still a believer in kind of the OTR theory of game design. I recognize the need to incorporate the input of everybody on the team, because like I say, we're not in this for the money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in it for the opportunity to be creative. But if the input that you're getting is harmful to the aesthetic vision, then you got to cut it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you simply have to say, no, this is going to ruin things. I mean, you know, example of a beautiful game that managed to retain its harmony and yet still be remarkably extreme was BioShock.
Mm.
You know, that completely outrageous Art Deco environment, you know, and you compare that to something like Gears of War with its endless concrete, you know,
yeah.
Now, you know, BioShock is just head and shoulders above something like Gears of War because it had a strong visual style that people could really get behind,
mm-hmm.
And be excited about, you know, mm-hmm. and that's, but it was still harmonious,
yeah.
You know, everything in it did belong together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that was that, you know, Levine just did not focus group the hell out of it. He said, no, this is how we're going to make things look.
Mm-hmm. You know? It's funny that you brought up BioShock. You know, Ken and I, we have gotten into a debated arguments in the past regarding BioShock 2.
2? You mean Infinite?
Yeah, Infinite.
2 is like that.
We always keep walking out.
We skip 2 because it doesn't exist.
Now, one thing that I want to go back to that you said a few minutes ago is regarding the different types of play styles and how people focus either on mechanics and optimization versus the narrative and the story. I think for me, I'm somewhat of middle, but I do lean more towards mechanics. I know, Ken, you said in the past that you're more narrative. I know you appreciate a lot more of the artistic games.
I wouldn't say narrative. I'll talk about experience. Mm-hmm. So it's a game like Gone Home to me is very engaging in a breath of fresh air compared to the other games I've played because of its environmental storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And yeah, and you know, I won't say that there are two kinds of game developers, but mm-hmm. there is definitely a continuum in which some people find some things more important than others, factors more important than others. And, you know, it is difficult to please them both. Mm-hmm. It's possible sometimes if you're lucky and you have a lot of money, but it is difficult.
Yeah. I would say also there's like a lot of people that hate games like Gone Home because they keep calling it Walking Simulator. I'm like, or like adventure games, calling them cutscene simulators. I'm like, listen, like you could simplify any game into the most mundane thing you wanted to. I don't think it's a very valid criticism.
Well, you know, if you don't like adventure games, then don't play adventure games.
I mean,
you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I mean, you know, personally, I find modern jazz boring, and you know, I prefer classical music that has like a melody that's going somewhere, that's trying to tell me something, you know, or classic rock or something like that. But you know, just kind of do, you know, it just sounds like elevator music to me. Well, you know, now that's partly because I'm a Philistine and I don't understand jazz that well. But you know, as far as I don't go around ragging on jazz. I just don't listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, if you don't like adventure games, then don't play adventure games. But you know, to get jump up and down and say they're worthless, they're useless. Well, you know, there's people that buy them. So,
yeah.
You know, it's like to each their own. You know, I'd rather personally drive a pickup truck than a Porsche, because I don't want to pay for the insurance on the Porsche. So. That's just me. Yeah.
Well, my original thought was regarding narrative versus optimization. To me, I guess where I draw the line is that I don't like to play games at the level of min-max. You know, when you see people who super optimize their play style down to the decimal point, when you basically get a point where you're essentially breaking the game. And we see this a lot in either RPGs or strategy games. Pretty much any games that give you hard numbers, it becomes very easy and very tempting to just play through saying, okay, I know that these three choices are always the best, and I'm just going to pick them, and the AI won't be able to handle it, and then, you know, the game is broken. It's a way people can beat the game on the hardest levels. And to me, that's where I just don't enjoy playing the game at that level. I do enjoy some narratives. If a good story is there, to me, it elevates a game. But when the mechanics just fall apart like that, the experience just becomes sour, in my opinion.
Well, it's certainly the case that a game with a strong story and bad mechanics is still a bad game.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that. Or if a game has what's the phrase I'm looking for? You're gonna wanna edit this. a dominant strategy. That's it. If a game has a dominant strategy, that mm-hmm. you know, there's only one or two best ways to play it, and there's no reason to ever try any other approach. You know, like for example, you know, if you play an RPG and the mage is totally overpowered and there's mm-hmm. not any point in ever playing a fighter, or you're playing a shooter game and there's one gun that is so much better than all the others that, you know, why mm-hmm. would you bother choosing another one? That's just a design mistake.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. You know, dominant strategies are bad, and I don't care how much narrative you do or don't have.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to balance your game no matter what you're doing. And you've got to balance it so that the player has, as Sid Meier says, meaningful choices to make.
Yeah.
And, you know, because that's part of why we play. And, yeah, there will be those who like to optimize absolutely everything and min-max everything and so forth. And I don't think it's wrong to make a game that people can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you'll have a bigger market if you make a game where you don't have to. You know, where as a player, I can say, this is a badass-looking shield. I don't care what its stats are. I'm going to play with a badass-looking shield because I like the way it looks. And you know, that's okay, too. You got to make sure that shield is still playable.
Yeah.
You know, that you don't end up only being able to play by the numbers. Because if that's the case, then you will only sell your game to people who like to play by the numbers.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, going back to what we were saying a few minutes ago regarding looking at bad game design as a great measurement for what can be considered good, I have to, of course, bring up your series of articles, the No Twink for yes. game designer articles. Now, you've been doing these, I believe, has it been every year or every other year that you've been writing these pieces?
It's every year, except 1 year. So at the very beginning, I wrote Bad Game Designer, No Twinkie, and then I didn't write one the next year, and then I did one, and after that, it's been every year. So I've been doing it since 1997, every year since then except one.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, yeah.
And what I love about these, and of course I'm going to have a link to them in the podcast notes, is that they just, in a way, they just encapsulate the design and the market at that time. When you look at some of your earlier pieces, there is, of course, posts about adventure games, you know, esoteric puzzle design, puzzles that just didn't make sense because that was popular during the late 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And one thing, I know we probably won't be able to talk too much about this today, but one thing that I love was that the second No Twinkie article, I think that was in 2000, one of the comments you said, and we sort of talked about this earlier, was regarding developers who basically stick to juvenile or, you know, pure titillation just for titillation's sake.
Mm-hmm.
Over-exaggerated breasts, you know, just complete male gaze. And how in 2000 you said, you know, we need to cut this out. And we talked about this before the cast, but, you know, it's 2014 and we're just now slowly getting to those types of issues.
What can I say? I was ahead of my time.
Yeah.
you know, it's, yes, right. We are, and the game industry is finally beginning to grow up. It has taken quite a long time, but the, you know, the increasing numbers of women who are in the industry and the increasing numbers of women who are playing games is helping that, as it, people are realizing that it's really kind of stupid to piss off a lot of the market. And, you know, the market is bigger. You know, the number of horny male virgins who as a percentage of the market is, you know, is shrinking. So, you know, we are, yes, we're starting to get there. We're realizing that. In addition to, look, this is just kind of obnoxious, we're also sort of starting to clue in about the fact that this is not necessarily financially smart, and that making games that appeal to both sexes will, surprisingly, make more money than making a game that appeals to only one. Yeah, right. So, but, you know, that was another one of the goals of the International Game Developers Association, actually, was, it was never an explicitly stated goal, but in the background, one of the things I really wanted to do was to try to encourage more women to get into the industry and to improve the way that women are depicted in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Just yesterday, I posted on Facebook a picture that I saw in the Lord of the Rings Online, where it was like, I think possibly the very first pregnant woman that I've ever seen in a video game.
Really?
It's like, you know, that's just an aspect of human life that most of the time we don't bother with. And, you know, of course, a lot of the time we're having adventures and shooting things and, you know, flying spacecraft and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's, you know, there's no need for it particularly. But at the same time, you know, it's part of the human condition, part of the human experience. And as we begin to branch out and to be about more things than just blowing stuff up,
mm-hmm.
you know, we want to include more of sort of normal human life. And I, you know, I think that's to everyone's advantage. Not all the time, not everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think if there were little kids in Grand Theft Auto that you could run over with your car, that would be a serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why there aren't any little kids in Grand Theft Auto. But yeah, it's become an overused word, but diversity is good.
Mm-hmm.
Variety, let's say. Let's call it variety. Variety is good.
Yeah.
I think only recently they've actually encapsulated a child character correctly with Clementine in The Walking Dead, if you played that.
I confess I haven't. Sorry.
It is probably, to me, the best child character in games ever created. I think this is like probably one of my favorites, along with dealing with minority character really well too, because the main character, the Everett, is just, you know, he's just, it's an office of race. He's not, you know, they don't shove in your face. They don't make him super urban. He's just a guy trying to live through the zombie apocalypse.
Right. Yeah. That's, you know, that's an important part of this sort of growing up process, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that very much interested me moving from the United States to Britain is that in the United States, it's still pretty rare to see mixed race relationships on TV. Mm-hmm. And when you do, it's an issue. And we have to discuss it. And we have to take it very seriously and what it's going to mean and so on. And in the UK, where there wasn't a civil war, and there was, but it was not about that, you know, and there are racial problems here in the UK, but it's just not quite the same. And it doesn't have this vast kind of superstructure of hatred that's associated with it. You can just have mixed race relationships on TV and nobody really talks about it. It's, it's just kind of like having somebody with blue eyes marry somebody with brown eyes. And, there's no real reason to bring it up. And that was very refreshing. And so it's great to me to hear that we're starting to see minority characters appearing in video games who are not stereotypes, who are not either big black badasses or, Native American trackers who can track anybody anywhere. Or whatever it is, incredibly good at math Asian people.
go ahead. But I'm just saying, you're right. Because, to me, Lee Everett, there was undertones of his race by the characters around him. Mm-hmm. But he was never overtly about it, which is good because, his first in focus is who he is, not his race. And I think that's important for whenever you're developing a minority character or, if you're doing based on identity that you're not, that to not make it that no one is encapsulates their entire being around just their race or just their gender. I think by doing that, you're always going to make a character one dimensional.
I think that is an excellent point. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And, as we create characters, to create a rich and fully rounded character, the decisions that character makes are a product of their character, their personality, mm-hmm. not their gender. It's not I do this because I am a woman. Mm-hmm. It's I do this because I am me. And that is the way I choose to, and you get, badass women like Ripley in Aliens, mm-hmm. and her behavior is kind of counter to expectations about her gender. But that's Ripley, man. You know what Ripley's like. That's the way she is.
So and she made one bad decision, though. She didn't go back to that cat.
Right. Well, but not saying every decision Ripley makes or any other character makes should necessarily be right either. It's like the decision should be a product of who they are. And obviously Ripley doesn't care that much about cats. So, you're so right. Define your character as a person. And naturally their gender and their race are going to inform certain aspects of it. But it's not the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem comes from where games kind of came from, or at least inspired by movies, right? It comes from cinema, and I think, sorry, one second, I've had to cut that out, but what I'm going to revert back, I was going to say is, I think game gets inspired by cinema, and what we see there is that because you only have 2 hours in the movie theater, you have to use stereotypes, you rely on stereotypes, to kind of, it's an easy way, because as soon as you throw an agent out there with glasses, you assume he is that super nerd who's an accountant or something crazy like that. And I think that games also are guilty of using the same kind of tropes, and because of that, it makes it even worse, because you're with them much, much longer.
It's not just the 2 hours, though. It's just plain sloppiness and not putting your back into it. To roll up your sleeves and do some real work. Yes, it is true that you when you have a limited amount of time to tell a story, you cannot make everybody a completely deep and rich character. But it is still possible to write, it is still possible to write good movies about rich characters if you are prepared to take the trouble. Mm-hmm. And I think, just a lot of people in the film industry and a lot of people in the game industry either are not willing to do the work or they don't have the talent to do it. One thing I would really, really like to see is for the quality of our writing to improve.
Yeah.
The first time I played Resident Evil, I was rooting for the monsters. shut these people up. My God, if I hear another word out of their mouths, I'll shoot myself.
Yeah.
So
you're almost a Jill sandwich.
Master of unlocking. There we go. It is really interesting about writing, about, as we said, that sometimes that time limit can affect it, but other times it could just be sloppiness. And as a counterexample, we're sort of seeing a real renaissance in terms of TV writing over the last few years, with shows like Breaking Bad, Game of Thrones, and a lot of other shows that they develop these characters out, not just across 2-3 episodes, but across multiple seasons, and they become very just fleshed out people. Like we saw, you know, the whole Walter White transformation in Breaking Bad. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of interesting to see how TV has evolved. And as you said, Ernest, that the video game industry is still kind of struggling to do that. And it could also be part of the fact that, as we said earlier, that there are two different types of audiences. We have the people who are into stories and narratives and who want to focus on character development. But then you have the people who just play games strictly from a mechanical point of view, who they don't care, you know, if this character is happy or sad. They care, you know, does it give them, you know, +3 sword damage here? Or yeah. Will this give me ending C that I've been trying to collect?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you are not going to, you know, for that kind of player, mm-hmm. the extra work necessary to make rich characters is not going to be rewarded because they're not going to care. And so you do have a sort of a problem there in that, you know, well, why should I put in a lot of trouble to make a rich character if my players don't care? And, you know, the answers might be, well, you should put in the trouble simply because it's worth it intrinsically.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, that gave some more value to it. And as you said, it's just to elevate things.
Yeah, yeah, right. You know, and I certainly agree about the quality of television recently, you know, and I think it has been kind of interesting to see that cable has really sort of been responsible for this. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when the time before cable, I'm that old, and, you know, there were 3 major networks plus PBS, mm-hmm. and they all had to appeal to the absolute least common denominator, which meant that all TV shows had to be equally stupid, mm-hmm. you know. And now you get things like HBO, and they are prepared to fund things for a more intelligent, mm-hmm. sort of, dare I say it, more highbrow audience. Mm. And that is, you know, that is made for. So things like The Sopranos, which is not just kind of a, you know, gangsters killing each other show. They are bringing in kind of genuine principles of drama. And that's all to the good, as far as I'm concerned. And I think it's the fact that they are cable, that they are in competition in sort of a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you know, but of course, we're still going to have the Kardashians. The Kardashians are not going to go away. But there is a place for Breaking Bad, mm-hmm. and I'm delighted to see it.
And I guess as a good example of how a show did elevate things, you know, sort of made waves when there wasn't any, as you said, in the early days, you know, TV was very homogenized. I tried flipping through, you know, those classic TV stations that they have now. And, you know, some of those old shows, it's just like, what the hell? People enjoyed this back then. Yes. And the example that I like to use in one of my favorite shows was The Twilight Zone and how mm-hmm. that really broke ground in the, I think it was late 50s, early 60s when it came out. And I just love the interviews like Rod Serling gave at the time, where he basically said that he wanted to make a show that wasn't, you know, cookie cutter, was homogenized. He wanted to elevate writing and TV for that time. And he saw like-minded individuals, and sort of that's how The Twilight Zone evolved and became really one of the first shows to push the boundaries of what you could do on TV.
Yeah, that was one for sure. You know, it was an intelligent, groundbreaking show. And, you know, we forget nowadays mm-hmm. Just how groundbreaking the original Star Trek was, too, at the time. I mean, you know, if you look at it now, you know, the acting is not that great and some of the plots are pretty funny and, mm-hmm. you know, and obviously the special effects are laughable. But nevertheless, compared to what was going on around it.
Yeah.
You know, there's an alien who's a member of the crew. Mm-hmm. There's a woman on the bridge. There's a black woman on the bridge.
Yeah.
Are you insane?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was pretty shocking stuff at the time. And yeah, and, you know, it was possible. And I'm just very pleased to see that it is more possible now. And, mm-hmm. you know, and things like Braid and The Walking Dead, I mean, obviously they're completely different games, but, mm-hmm. and, you know, Gone Home and so forth. We're moving into an era where these kinds of aesthetic endeavors are beginning to gain respect.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been made possible by indie development.
Definitely.
And, you know, and by some, a few really enlightened people, you know, that who are the Rod Serlings of the game industry? You know, they're people like, oh, what's that guy at BioWare? David Gator.
Mm-hmm.
you know, people like David Gator at BioWare, who are pushing the boundaries a little bit, and they're not content with, you know, the usual anymore. Mm-hmm. So it can happen at big companies, although it is more difficult to get it to happen.
And I think that's an amazing question to ask. You know, who are the Rod Serlings of the game industry? Who are the people who are making these waves and are just designing games to be the lowest common denominator? And you're right, Ernest, and that's something that we've been saying now for the last few years, that the indie developers have really sort of taken that torch in a sense, because they're not, you know, shackled to having to make a game that must sell 3 million copies. Or a game that must be aimed exactly at the 18 to 30 white male demographic. And it will be interesting, as you said, we're slowly making that move. We are seeing more people talking about women in the game industry. We are seeing more pushes for better narratives. And I think it will be very interesting just to see how this decade will end in terms of, you know, who's still making games, how game design or how just game development will change between now and 2020.
Yeah. No. Yeah,
I see a kind of a backwards trend a little bit too in the AAA game industry. Just talking about earlier about like those stereotypes and tropes and bad writing. Mm-hmm. I feel like, I don't know if it's true or not, but I know that a lot of directors or failed directors from Hollywood, at least they say the failed directors from Hollywood go into the game industry and they try to replicate the same kind of feel. And that's why I'm not saying that's the core only reason, but I mean, I think that's another reason why I have a big push for cinematics and big cinematics within games. I feel like that's a big problem with at least the Eastern developers with like the Final Fantasy series, where it is cutscene simulator. And
we have, yeah, sorry.
And just to summarize it, I mean, to finish it off. And well, that's actually stuff. So go on.
We have long suffered. Excuse me. We have long suffered from Hollywood envy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their budgets are 10 times what ours are. That is starting to change, but you know, still on generally speaking. You know, they have all this star power. They get all this love. they have an award show that is watched literally around the world, and so on. And I've been battling this battle for years. You know, dealing with the fact that we envy Hollywood and we sort of wish we were them, and so on. And I could talk for about another hour about that. But generally speaking, game developers who wish they were film directors make bad games. And film directors who wish they were game developers also make bad games.
Yeah.
there are sufficient differences in the medium that you really can't just apply all the same aesthetics from one to the other.
And definitely, I think that's some really interesting stuff about the differences between cinematography and the game development. But unfortunately, we are out of time. I know, Ernest, you have to get going. As we said, Ernest is in the UK, so it's 5-6 hours ahead, and we kind of had to schedule this to work around everyone's schedule. But yeah, Ernest, if you do have any free time, we have so much more we could probably talk about. We could probably spend 2-3 more podcasts on. So hopefully, if you have any more free time coming up, we would love to have you back on and pick your brain more about the industry and design.
Thank you. I'll be happy to.
Awesome. And Ken, it was great talking to you. I know we had to move everyone's schedule around to get this cast going.
It's okay.
All right. So with that said, we're going to wrap things up for this podcast. And as I just said, we're going to hopefully shoot for part 2, and who knows, maybe even a part 3 at some point. Thank you for tuning into the cast, and as always, for those of you listening, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, there are several ways to do it. You can either submit a guest piece or be a future podcast member by going to Submissions 1 on the front page. That will take you to email links as well as guidelines. And for those of you interested in monetary-wise, we are continuing to run our Patreon campaign to hopefully secure monthly funding to start to make improvements to Game Wisdom. You can find all the information for that under our Patreon banner that is also on the front page. So, with that said, thank you for tuning in to the Perceptive Podcast this week. Have a great weekend, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.